I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Taxpayer concerns over transparency, operations, and misuse of funds in Clay County spurred residents to ask for a state-level audit last year. Next came a lawsuit filed by the county trying to limit the scope of that examination. Now, in an open letter to citizens, the state auditor says, quote, unprecedented obstruction from county officials is keeping her office from receiving necessary documents. Today, we'll learn more about who and what may be hindering that process. Then, do identity politics and talk of tolerance take away from open and inclusive discourse? We'll meet one professor who believes the shift in American culture to be more sensitive is putting ideas and progress at risk. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's been about 15 months since a group of more than 9,000 citizens in Clay County, that's the county that includes the eastern half of Kansas City's Northland, as well as the cities of Liberty, Gladstone, North Kansas City, Kearney, 9,000 citizens signed a petition forcing an audit by the state auditor's office about the ethics and accountability of the county government. Since then, well, in some ways, not much has happened. The county has sued the auditor's office, seeking to limit the scope of her investigation. Earlier this month, the auditor wrote an open letter to the county citizens saying she was facing, quote, an unprecedented level of obstruction from county officials. We spoke about this on a program back in July of 2018, just after that petition was filed. And today, we've asked back a couple of the same guests to check in on the state of governance in Missouri's fifth largest county. Jerry Nolte's presiding commissioner of Clay County. He's a Republican. That makes him the chair of the three-person legislative body that governs there. Commissioner Nolte, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
And Sherry Duffett is head of Citizens for a Better Clay County. She spearheaded the petition effort and is a former county employee herself. Sherry, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you both. Jerry Nolte, why is the state auditor facing an, quote, unprecedented level of obstruction from Clay County as she attempts to audit the county's operations?
Well, just to give a little brief outline, she requested some records. Those records apparently were not forthcoming in her estimation. She issued a subpoena, and then the county sued, and then we kind of find ourselves where we are. In my opinion, and I'm in the minority on this, I don't believe that we should have resisted the subpoena. I believe we should supply the records requested by the auditor.
You're the presiding commissioner. How come the county commission hasn't honored those requests?
Because it's a 2-to-1 vote. The other two commissioners disagree with my point of view, so they have decided to go forward with these legal delays.
We should note that we did invite Eastern District Commissioner Luann Ridgway, who's a Republican, and Western District Commissioner Gene Owen, who's a Democrat, to join us today. We called both their offices. We left voicemails. We sent emails Tuesday and Wednesday last week. We have not heard back from them. They had also declined to join us last year when we spoke about this. Sherry Duffett, remind us what the issues were that led you to seek this audit in the first place.
Okay. Well, I didn't specifically spearhead the petition drive. It was several people that were involved with that. There was about 10 of us that really got together and got this going. We were seeing some issues that were going on, lack of transparency, and they were removing public comments from the agenda so that people could, that the citizens could not have an opportunity to come up and speak about any issues that they may have had with the county. And just there were some expenditures that didn't seem right, accountability of certain assets that were lacking. So it was a number of things
that
we thought.
There was talk, I recall, of $600 coffee makers or of hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on legal fees for the county.
Yes, and that those legal fees are still being paid, hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, I think last year it was close to $1 million were spent on legal fees.
So when you hear things like this open letter from Auditor Nicole Galloway, who says she's faced an unprecedented level of obstruction, what reaction does that trigger in you?
Well, I'm very frustrated. And I most of the people that I talk to that are keeping up with this are very frustrated also. They don't believe that there should be any delay in there. If there's anything, they should go on with it. If there's nothing to hide, then let's prove us wrong and show us that there's nothing to hide. But like you said, the $600 coffee pots, the $80,000 horse barn. There's just something's going on in the back behind the scenes, and the citizens are not aware of it.
Obviously, the purpose of the audit would be to try to seek some evidence one way or the other to find out if that's true. Do you have evidence that there is mismanagement or a misspending of funds, that something illegal is happening in Clay County?
We specifically can't really comment on that because of the ongoing legal. But I believe we have some things that should be looked at. Violation of sunshine laws is probably the number one.
Can you give me a specific example? Like when were sunshine laws violated?
Oh my gosh, you caught me off guard on that one. Just the fact that we can't speak, the public can't speak. Anybody should be able to go up and speak at a meeting. If you request a sunshine record.
Right, that's the open records law
right.
in Missouri.
They want to charge you for it exorbitantly because it has to go through an attorney. And where before that was under the clerk's office and it was free. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time it's free. You had to pay for a reproduction cost. And even Commissioner Nolte has to sunshine requests for himself.
Is that true, Commissioner Nolte, that when you request documents under the state's open records laws, you have to pay a fee to the county to get them to release the documents to you?
Yes, that's right. I have asked that those fees be waived for me because it's part of my job as presiding commissioner to understand what's going on in the county. And when I cannot get the information I feel I need to do my job, I've filed sunshine requests, and to fulfill those requests, I've paid the bill for getting that information. I certainly understand the idea of paying for copies as far as, you know, just the general expense.
Journalists have to do that too.
Exactly. So, we're talking about a few cents per page, which is pretty nominal. The fees that I've seen out there exceed that by a good bit because we're paying for legal counsel to be able to review them, which at their hourly rate is pretty substantial.
Who's hiring the legal counsel for the county?
Counsel is hired or contracted, depending on which ones you're talking about, with a majority vote of the commission.
And what counsel has been hired?
For Sunshine Request, it's Spencer Fain.
Spencer Fain, the law firm in Kansas City.
Correct.
Do you have any problem with the kinds of legal services that are being provided, or you just object to the idea that the county is spending money on these legal expenses?
Both, actually. I think the spending on legal fees has gone through the roof. On the audit thing alone, we're over $100,000 as far as I can tell, and there's no end of it in sight. But as far as the previous process for getting sunshine requests fulfilled, it would go through the clerk's office. And then from there, generally they were given, unless there was some legal question. Now I understand it's pretty routine to even the most mundane requests go through legal, which means those fees are assessed and then charged to the person who is requesting it.
Now, as I mentioned, we did try to get the other two commissioners to comment on the show so we could better understand their perspective on this. Since they aren't here, let me try my best to represent what they are saying. Back in January, the county released a statement at the time this lawsuit was filed that said Auditor Nicole Galloway's actions were unconstitutional. It accused her of releasing, quote, misleading press releases and using, quote, political rhetoric. Is it safe to assume that does not represent your view, Commissioner Nolte?
Not only is it safe to say that does not represent my view, it is also safe to say I was not consulted a lot of times, and we just had a process come up where I learn about press releases when a reporter asks me about them.
But I got this press release. It's on letterhead from the county commission. You're the presiding commissioner.
Could you forward it to me when you get those? Because I'd really like to see them before a reporter calls me. It's a little embarrassing, to tell you the truth.
So, how does that happen? Give us a little glimpse into how county government works in Clay County. Who actually wrote the statement? Who published it in a way that you didn't know about it?
Another great question. We had the issue came up just a few weeks ago of a press release going out that was unsigned. As you know, as someone in the news business, when you get a press release from any organization, it usually has a contact person and their contact information. This was anonymous. I don't understand anonymous press releases. That makes no sense. And when I asked who wrote it, there was no single person. There is no one person apparently responsible.
The statement you're talking about from 2 weeks ago says, among other things, once again, auditor Nicole Galloway is attempting an audit by press release rather than simply getting to work on the audit requested by the citizens of Clay County. The press release goes on to say that the county has provided dedicated office space that she has allowed to sit vacant for months, that it's provided 300,000 lines of financial data. But then they go on to give some of the reasons. This anonymous, as you said, this unsigned statement from the county commission also says it is for a judge to decide if the state auditor may access personnel records containing HIPAA-protected information and the attorney-client privileged communications of Clay County. Do you understand what that statement is talking about?
As far as I know, I don't know that the state auditor is interested in HIPAA-related information. I'm a little bit confused by that. I think also the auditor, I would hope, would understand that there's no point in requesting attorney-client privilege information. It sounds as though a lot of this has just been taken off. I've seen some of the redacted documents, not related to this, but prior to that I've had problems with, and the redaction is heavy-handed, to say the least.
Sherry, you were part of this group of citizens who filed a petition, 9,000 people, but that was a year and a half ago. Is there anything that you're now able to do? Are you an active part of this process?
Yes, we have been keeping up with this, and we're revamping up our efforts. We have organized another group called Better Clay County, and we're going to be coming up with a website real soon to keep people up to date, where they can go in onto that website and see what is happening, what the latest things are happening, because you're seeing all this stuff on this social media page or this social media page, and it's to keep everything together, and it will be very factual. Nothing will be opinionated. It'll be very nonpartisan, and it will be just facts and information. And that's where we're going forward with now. And I would like to comment one more thing about who's making these anonymous press releases. The commission voted 2-1 to delegate almost all of their authority to decision-making, everyday operation and decision-making, to the county administrator. Well, as you know, the county administrator left last year. So now all those responsibilities have been delegated down to assistant county administrators. And those are the people that are responsible for releasing these press releases. They wouldn't be going out unknown to anybody. So I'm sure that someone knows who initiated that.
I should say that the press release says it is from the offices of the Clay County Commission. Other media have asked the two other commissioners who are not here today. Luann Ridgway has said she agrees with the content, although it's not clear to me that she said she wrote the statement. And Jean Owen has not commented at all in any of the publications I have seen. I guess I'm curious, Commissioner Nolte, what you think can be done about this? Are you, because you're in the minority in this 2-1 series of votes, are you powerless to address these issues? Is there not information you can be providing to the auditor? Are you able to correct any of these procedures that are, in your view, limiting the flow of information?
Yes, there are things that I can and things that I do as far as disseminating more information, being the advocate out there for this. I am absolutely and still in favor of an immediate release of this information to the auditors. Get the audit done and get it through. One thing that I think that's important is the audit is being delayed, but I don't believe it will be stopped. The people have spoken. This is what they want. And in fact, I think something that we need to do is to keep the people involved. And by that, I mean, after we do get this audit report, I'm advocating that we put together an ad hoc citizens committee to review this and advise the commission, because we need to be looking at whatever the report is and reforming our the way our government is operating.
I should note that if there is anyone listening, whether it's one of the county commissioners or someone else who works in county government who can offer an alternative view on this, we would love for you to call in. Our number is 816-235-2888, and you're welcome to give us a call. Commissioner Nolte, you also introduced a resolution last Monday that would require all commissioners to have 24 hours to review any communications or press release from the county. How'd that go?
Not overly well from my point of view. It ended up being voted down 2-1. Ironically, we had the discussion between ourselves. I had gotten Commissioner Ridgway's views, and she spoke on her thoughts on the matter. I went to Commissioner Owen before going to the citizens who had lined up to speak. Commissioner Owen decided to move the previous question, which immediately cuts off all debate. So citizens who had lined up to express their opinions were forced to sit down because that is a privileged motion, which I could not fight. And so they basically just told the In my view, they just told the citizens to shut up and sit down. That is not acceptable.
I guess when you hear all this, Sherry Duffett, do you feel like government in Clay County is broken beyond repair? Does this go beyond just the three elected office holders on the commission at this point to a whole system that just isn't working?
Absolutely. And I think most people don't care until it affects them personally. But I've seen such a growing number of people become interested in what is going on up there that we feel like it's just basically a train wreck up there. And we try to go to the meetings as much as we can, but unfortunately they're at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday morning every other week. So, and sometimes not even then, they change the schedule then.
Meetings are at 2 o'clock in the morning?
10 o'clock.
Oh, 10 o'clock in the morning. Okay.
10 a.m. And so that's hard for people to come to. But the ones that, if they do make an effort to come up there to speak about something, I think they should be given the right to speak.
But to the extent that they're not being given that right or previous question motions are cutting off comments, I mean, can you give us some positive approach here? What is the positive outcome that could come of all this? What do you think can, with any probability, actually happen?
Well, probably the best possibility or probability would be for people to look at who they're voting for next year in 2020. I think that there's some issues that are going to be commencing because of the certificates of participation, the $52 million that we have now that the 2-1 commissioners voted on. And I think they're going to try to stall it until after the election to see who is going to be in office. Mm. They want to get that going. But again, I have seen so much interest in county government through my efforts and through my interaction with the public, that people are getting geared up about this. They're getting interested. They're knowing what's going on. They're paying attention. And I think it's going to be, that to me is more exciting than just about anything.
We're starting to see some ramifications down the line from some of this chaos, I guess is the right word, in Clay County government. The budget of the sheriff's office has been one of the issues in the news. It was cut. There were reports that this month that the county jail didn't have the budget to provide inmates with adequate food and health care. A judge had to order the $1 million restored to the budget, although Commissioners Owen and Ridgway are actually appealing that ruling in court as well. Commissioner Nolte, what other implications are there for this ongoing saga?
The thing is, it is a deterioration of the governmental process, and we need to be pulled back and do our jobs. When you're talking about the issue with the sheriff's department, we're talking about the issue is the contracts for clothing, food, medical needs of the detainees, many of whom are awaiting trial and not been convicted. We are legally obligated to provide those services, provide that to the detainees. And more than that, it is just simple humanity that we provide for those people that we have in our custody.
Do you worry, Sherry, in the support of your organization? I've heard you use the word nonpartisan several times, but in fact, there's a lot of partisan rhetoric going on in this conversation. A lot of folks are suggesting that State Auditor Nicole Galloway, who is the leading Democratic candidate for governor, that there's some sort of political motivation for her actions. How do you see that, and how do you avoid the sense that this is a political dispute?
I don't think this is a political dispute. I think people see that there's problems in Clay County government, and has nothing to do with who the state auditor is, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. They would have done the same thing if we would have turned those petitions over to them.
And is that how you see it as well, Commissioner Nolte?
I do. I support going forward with the audit. I am a supporter of the current governor, Mike Parson, and I do realize that Auditor Galloway is likely opponent at this point, but I support the whole idea of going forward with the audit and doing the job we have in front of us and letting the politics take care of itself afterwards.
I'm curious, too. You, Commissioner Nolte, said you do have access to some of the information. You do support this release of documents. You have not been particularly vocal in your criticisms, your calling out of your fellow commissioners. Is that you've noted where you disagree with them? But do you feel like there is more you could do to push this issue?
I would disagree with that. I've been very vocal, and I think if you were to talk to my two colleagues, they would probably say I've been too vocal when it comes to voicing my opposition to what's going on the audit. I'm out on Facebook probably a couple of times. I speak to different news media organizations, and I am one of the signers of the audit petition, along with 70 other former and sitting elected officials. So this is really a people's movement, and the people's will has to be respected.
We do have one call coming in from Clay County. Let's talk to Tyler. Hello.
Good morning.
Tyler, tell us, you live in Clay County?
I do.
So what's your comment talking today about the state auditor's ongoing effort to audit the operations of the county government?
So I'm familiar with the process, and it's my understanding that the state auditor's office never really did ask for those records officially, that they said, would you provide them to us?
And are you speaking from some sort of inside knowledge of the auditor's request, or is this just what you've heard?
It's what I've been told from some people with some inside information.
Can you be a little more specific?
It's what I've been told by people with inside information.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call, Tyler. I don't know that that's we wouldn't probably allow that as sourcing in the journalistic world. What are you? You're shaking your head.
I actually believe I know that the Senator Auditor Galloway has subpoenaed records, actual records, and has been very specific about what she wants. And that from every office, most of the other offices have cooperated. The assessor's office, the collector's office, the treasurer's office, they've cooperated. It's the commission that has been the two commissioners that have blocked this effort. It's not the auditor.
Very quickly, with the time we have left, Commissioner Nolte, what's next? What's the next point of decision for the commission about this matter?
The point of decision for the commission really, in my world, would be to relinquish our legal challenge. What in reality what's going to happen is the judge will make some kind of a ruling based on the challenge to the subpoena, and then we go from there. But I have every confidence that we are going to have an audit. It's just delaying it.
And when do we expect that that will be?
That depends upon how vigorously the other two commissioners try to block it and how much money of the taxpayers they're willing to spend.
All right. Well, we do not yet have resolution on this, but I'm sure we'll have more opportunities to talk about it. That's Presiding Commissioner of Clay County, Jerry Nolte. Also with us, Sherry Duffett, Citizens for a Better Clay County. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, have academia and liberal culture in America come to fear real diversity of thought in ways that are profoundly illiberal? A new book argues that's the case. We'll talk with its author and more when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you're missing Steve this morning, you can get his newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske for insights from Steve and highlights from the Up to Date team. And you can get more Steve Kraske in your inbox every single Monday. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. And tomorrow, many of us hear the word shark and think of a bloodthirsty predator. Sharks, though, are more vulnerable to humans than we are to them. Learn how they contribute to the vitality of the world's oceans tomorrow on Up to Date. Liberal thought, and for that matter, people who identify as liberals, are inclusive of all ideas and open to the perspectives of people of all backgrounds. Or at least that's the story liberals tell themselves. But is it true? Or is it as true as it used to be? My next guest suggests in a new book that the liberal tradition, with its talk about white privilege and cultural appropriation, is heading off the rails, at least in some places, and that many who purport to work for a more open society may, in fact, be undermining it. Robert Boyers is editor of Salmagundi and a professor at Skidmore College, author of many books and essays. He joins us from WAMC in Albany, New York. Mr. Boyers, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So your book is called The Tyranny of Virtue. Who are the tyrants that you're calling out in this book?
Well, they're a very various population, and they include lots of academics, professors, administrators, and in many cases even students, many of whom I confront on my own campus and on many of the other campuses where I'm invited to lecture and speak. And the tyranny I'm referring to takes many different forms, and what I've tried to do in my book, at least, is to provide numbers of stories and anecdotes and so on to make vivid the various ways in which this tyranny operates.
Now, your publicity materials, and I think they're reflective of your general reputation, call you a quote liberal public intellectual, but your critique is of liberalism, or at least what liberalism has become.
Absolutely. I mean, I am an old style liberal, and I came of age in the 1960s when we were fighting on various fronts, which included the fight against various kinds of overt repression exercised both by the government in Washington and by people in the media who wanted to prevent us from saying things and publishing things that apparently we oughtn't to have said. So I come from that tradition, a tradition in which censorship was a negative term, something to be fought against. And I've lived long enough to watch my own cohort, my own left liberal cohort, seeming to fight the fight to make censorship, at least for certain things, once more respectable. It doesn't seem to me respectable, but that seems to be where the struggle now exists.
And censorship is strong language. I mean, what is it that you think is being censored?
Well, it's very strong language, and of course, the censorship usually doesn't take a overt legal form. People aren't being prohibited from opening the pages of a book or buying one at a bookstore, lots of people are being shamed when they say things of which others disapprove. And that's where the kind of censorship comes into play. I'll give you a very compact example. Recently, we had an eruption at my New York State Summer Writers Institute in July, and various people asked me, as the director of the program, to make a vow and put it in writing to members of the program that certain kinds of language would never again be used in workshops, public readings, and so on. And I said, well, you're basically asking me to set myself up as a censor who's going to vet in advance what people are going to say at a public reading, what kinds of manuscripts students are going to turn in at a workshop. I can't become that kind of a censor. I don't want to be that kind of a censor. And when I said that, a number of the people who had put this demand to me said, oh, we're not talking about censorship. I said, well, I think you are. Right? I mean, if you're inviting me to make this promise or this vow, that seems to me exactly what you're requiring, in fact, demanding.
But isn't there a distinction to be made between censorship, sort of saying these thoughts, these ideas are off limits, and I guess a sensitivity to the way that words have an impact on groups of people, many of whom have already experienced great deals of oppression and attack from dominant cultural groups in society.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is an arena in which what we need to do is to make meaningful distinctions between one sort of thing and another, one sort of sensitivity and another. Nobody I know in campus life is in favor of free speech, if by free speech we mean the right of people to yell nasty or disgusting epithets at people who belong to a particular group or ethnicity or gender orientation. I mean, if we're talking about sensitivity and political correctness in that sense, I think pretty much everyone in college and university life is on the same page when it comes to those kinds of things. But when that kind of sensitivity, so-called, is extended to many other things, things which are sometimes referred to as microaggressions, then we're talking about something entirely different. If we say, for example, that the black writer Walter Mosley, who wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about this 2 weeks ago, is not allowed to read out the N-word in a text when he's teaching it in a class, then we're talking about a different kind of sensitivity. If we're talking about the notion that a person is not allowed to write a poem or publish a poem in which he tries to imagine the lives and the speech of people who are different from himself, then we're dealing with another kind of sensitivity, and we are dealing with increasingly a kind of surveillance culture in which people are being surveilled and called out and shamed for doing things which are not in themselves hostile or oppressive.
So your book is a series of essays sort of taking on different concepts or even different words that are yes. that are often part of academic culture and these conversations about cultural sensitivity. Your first chapter is on privilege, and I actually recall when that essay came out in magazine form last year in the American Scholar, the title of it there was The Privilege Predicament. What is the predicament that society is facing today around this concept of privilege?
Well, I think, it's obvious, I think, first, that it's necessary to say that privilege is real. Privilege exists.
And privilege, we should say, I guess you'd describe it as a sort of a systematic advantage that certain groups, especially white people, especially males, have sort of accumulated over generations or centuries that make the current playing field unlevel. Is that a fair description of what privilege is?
Very fair. Privilege obviously comes in many different forms and varieties. And one of the problems I think that we have in talking about privilege is that it has come to be used in an entirely undifferentiated way. Even the expression white privilege, when you think about it, is on the one hand entirely understandable, and if used in a very precise way, entirely valid. And then if used in a careless and undifferentiated way, it is absurd. White privilege is enjoyed by white people in many, many different ways. But when you talk about white privilege to people white people who live in poverty and who've never seen, so far as they can tell, any of the particular advantages of so-called white privilege coming their way, people who are in the midst of an opioid epidemic and out of work, and you harass them with talk about white privilege, you are driving them away, you are alienating them, and horribly, I think, you are encouraging them to think that that the kinds of people who speak for them are people like Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's about their reaction to the term.
Yes.
I mean, isn't it still true that whether you said who do not realize it or as far as they understand it themselves, I mean, isn't it true that people can experience privilege, can experience that advantage as white people, whether they acknowledge it or recognize it or not?
they can experience it, yes, but they experience it in drastically different ways. And I think to ignore the way that different people experience white privilege is to ignore the reality on the ground. I think it is clear that some people make their whiteness an advantage, and they do that in a variety of ways we're all too familiar with, in terms of creating a playing field which privileges white people when it comes to getting jobs and promotions and so on. That there's no one who understands the history of the United States who doesn't really understand that that has occurred. But then again, there is privilege and there is privilege. And I think unless we're willing to talk about the differences, the different ways in which different groups of people experience that so-called advantage, we're not really addressing the real lives of people. And I think, again, that's something that happened to us on my side of the political world, in the liberal side, in 2016.
It seems, I have to say, from reading this, that it feels like a very deeply personal issue for you. You're not really just addressing this as an academic, giving 30,000 foot cultural reflections. You seem to worry about the things you're seeing here, and the ways that they might put you at odds with your friends at a dinner party or your children.
Well, that's true. Absolutely. And that's one of the things I wanted to do in this book, is to bear witness to these issues in a very personal and intimate way. Even going so far, as you suggest, to talk about conversations that I've been having with my own adult children on these issues, not just privilege, but the whole range of issues that I take up in the book. These are real things. They are real problems. And I think as a liberal, what I want to do is to suggest that there are various valid ways to come at these questions and these issues, and attempts to sort of shut down the conversation because purportedly, we have all the answers. We know what is the proper and correct way to think about these issues. Seems to me to be a failure of liberalism, something which I see more and more prevalent on college campuses.
You're listening to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison. I'm talking with author Robert Boyers, whose new book is The Tyranny of Virtue: Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. You tackle quite a number of these political heresies in the book. What was the hardest one for you to write about?
Well, in some ways, the most frustrating aspect of the whole thing in academic life for me has to do with the notion of appropriation, which is an idea that cuts in many different directions and affects many conversations having to do with identity and privilege and so on. And so I devoted a whole chapter to that, but in many other parts of the book, I come back to the subject as well.
And so, this would be sort of the question of whether, I mean, conventionally stated, the question of whether you, for example, as a white person, can take and explore ideas from other cultures with authenticity and integrity.
Exactly. And so, you know, basically, when you think about the question of appropriation, it seems to me it's a perfectly legitimate question on the face of it. It's a question which, as a professor of English literature and a literary critic who's written many books, I've looked at from many different angles over the last half century. It is always legitimate to ask, when someone appropriates material from another source, from another person, from another tradition, to ask how well that material has been used. Has it been used in a legitimate way? Has it been used to enrich our understanding of the lives of the people whose situation is narrated in a novel? Do people do justice to something when they borrow a piece of material?
But doesn't the race or the culture of the person who's doing the comparing or who's doing the using, isn't that relevant?
That's now become... that's now become relevant, and that's one of the issues that I'm attempting to argue against in my book. I think it is not relevant. I think it's relevant to ask the question, but it's not relevant to declare categorically that people of one kind ought to stay in their own lane and not even attempt to imagine the lives of other people. That would seem to me to pretty much eliminate most imaginative literature that we've ever had. And it certainly cuts out a great many of the classic texts and the contemporary novels of great writers.
But just to push back a little bit,
sure.
I mean, you represent a particular perspective, a particular background, a particular set of cultural assumptions. I don't think anyone's saying it's not legitimate for you to comment or question on other cultures, but isn't it perfectly appropriate to criticize your perspective for whatever the limitations are that are reflected by the background you come from?
Oh, sure, absolutely. But of course, even when you say the background I come from, what background do I come from? I come from many backgrounds. I am white. I am Jewish. I am working class. I am straight. I am married. I have children. I'm a professor. I write from within the liberal tradition, sometimes highly critical of the liberal tradition, unlike other white Jewish middle-class people who write about those subjects. So when you say the background I come from, what exactly does that mean? I come from many backgrounds. And when someone objects to the notion that a person like me should be able to write about the lives of black citizens of South Africa, I'm sorry. I'm going to push back against that. There was a very prominent case 3 years ago involving a controversial painting by a white woman named Dana Schutz that hung in the Whitney Museum in their biennial exhibition. And there were protests about the painting. The painting is called Open Casket. And it's based upon a famous, iconic photograph of a black man named Emmett Till, who had been murdered more than 50 years earlier in a very famous case.
Yes.
So there were all sorts of protests. People stood up in the museum and attempted to put their bodies in front of the painting. There were petitions circulated demanding that the painting not only be taken down from the walls, but destroyed. Why? Because it was a painting made by a white painter. The black novelist Zadie Smith wrote about this incident, and she said, look, it is perfectly appropriate to ask whether that painting by Dana Schutz does justice to the subject it purports to represent. I, Zadie Smith, she said, do not think it does justice to the situation it purports to represent. But, she said, the notion that this painter, because she is white, had no legitimate right to make that painting or to try to represent that experience is absurd and philistine. I like that argument, and it seems to me right on the money.
So I guess my question is, how should academic communities like the one you are in or broader elements of society respond to I guess I will call them distasteful ideas. So here at UMKC, University of Missouri, Kansas City, where we are located, earlier this year, there was a group called the Young Americans for Freedom, a club on campus sat at a table on campus with a sign that said, hate speech is free speech. They brought in a speaker who was deemed by many to be painful in his words toward the transgender community. Last year at the University of Kansas, there was a series of incidents where white nationalist messages were written in chalk on sidewalks around campus. Shouldn't academic communities be able to sort of name things as offensive and limit their ability to be spoken when they cause actual pain or harm to people?
I entirely agree. I am not an absolutist proponent of so-called free speech. I do not believe that free speech includes the right to insult persons or groups or to spread hate, not at all. So there are people, of course, I know and you know, who are absolutists when it comes to free speech, and they think anything goes. I'm not one of those people.
So how should an academic community respond to something like that?
I think if it's anything like what you're describing as hate speech, I think the academic community must move to prohibit it. And in my experience, at least, virtually every academic community I know has done so. How is it done? Well, if anyone chalks hateful messages on a wall or a board, and the person is identified, the person is punished. The person is brought up on charges. That seems to me entirely reasonable, entirely fair. If a group on campus mobilizes to bring to campus a speaker who is known to spread hate or violence or to incite violence, then the community is well within its rights to prohibit the appearance of that speaker. Again, I have no ambivalence about that whatsoever. But when that instinct to create a safe space extends to a great many other things that are very far removed from hate speech, then I think we have a problem.
Before we go, and I want this question to not seem disrespectful to you, but you are no longer a young man. I think it's fair to say. I think a lot of people might fear a certain get off my lawn factor is at work here. Kids these days. Is this what this is? Are you looking back towards the end of your academic career and saying, "Boy, things aren't the way they used to be"?
By no means. I've been fighting this battle on campuses now for at least 30 years. And by the way, this struggle about certain intolerant elements in within liberalism itself goes back a very long way. It goes back at least to the time of Lionel Trilling's famous book, 1950, called The Liberal Imagination, where Trilling vowed to try to fight certain elements within his own liberal tradition. So this is nothing new, and it has nothing to do with some nostalgia of going back to a time which, frankly, never exists. There have always been all kinds of struggles on college and university campuses, ideological and otherwise.
Yes.
You know, I'm trying to identify something which is real and present, and I think the anecdotes and the stories I tell in the book make it very clear that it is real.
That's Robert Boyers. He is the editor of Salmagundi and a professor at Skidmore College and the author of The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. I wish we had longer to talk. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you were listening on Friday, you heard us talk with Shankar Vedantam, the host of NPR's Hidden Brain. You can find that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can also find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Join us tomorrow. We'll talk about what it means to center the voices of Native women in the dialogue on feminism. Our program's produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date